General relativity. Actually, can someone just shut the door? There's a bit of a noise. Well, it's useful to have an action principle for general relativity, in part because it puts now Einstein gravity on the same footing as the other field theories. So now you sort of have a full Lagrangian principle for both gravity as well as the rest of your matter content. But also, it's very useful to have a gravitational action, because there are situations where you may actually want to compute the action itself. For example, if you wanted to calculate some sort of tunneling process, then you wouldn't, if you wanted to know an amplitude or a probability for tunneling, then typically that's given by exponential of minus action. So you need to know whether there is an action that makes sense for gravity. Okay, so what actually stops us from just doing the obvious thing in terms of integration? So typically, if you were just going to integrate on a four-dimensional space, you would just have integral d4x. But of course, these coordinates x have no absolute meaning in general relativity, because coordinates are just a statement about some local choice of chart on your manifold. And we can change coordinates. And under a change of coordinates, this object d4x is not invariant.
In flat space time.
I'm working around on it. No, it's simply a statement that you would think. You know how to deal with this, obviously, in flat space time. And so what I'm going to do is just simply show how that generalizes to a more arbitrary metric, even when the metric is not flat. So, normally you know exactly what's going on, you've got your Jacobian, but what you would really like is to have a measure which is completely covariant, something which under a coordinate transformation gives you an invariant quantity, okay? So, other than just how you choose your rulers, okay? So, this thing, as Hubert pointed out, the fact that this thing is not invariant is something that's very familiar, because you've met the Jacobian quite early on when you first did multiple integration, right? So this is not going to stun anyone here. But what I want to do now is to find a way of making this invariant
but a way which is not sort of keyed into just having flat R4. So what I want to do is to consider the determinant of the metric, then I want to think about how that actually transforms under a coordinate transformation. So if I think about the metric you can think about it as just a matrix. If you do a coordinate transformation, the metric is covariant. So the components of the metric transform covariantly via the coordinate transformation matrix. So when you take the determinant of the metric, you're simply taking the determinant of a sort of product of three matrices, and so you simply get that the transformed determinant is the original determinant times the square of the transformation matrix determinant of that. So if I multiply my d4x by the square root of the determinant of the metric, I get something which is covariant. So this now is an invariant object. And so typically, just for shorthand, we just tend to write root g to mean the square root of the modulus of the determinant of gab. You write it so often you don't want to have to go through the whole part of writing mod dec g each time. So what this is actually a covariant expression of the volume element on your space-time. So this now means that we have a way of writing an integral. We can now integrate scalars on our manifold because this thing takes care of the way our volume, our integration measure transforms under coordinate transformations. And so if we multiply it by a scalar, we can now get covariant integrals. We can get answers that are not dependent on a particular coordinate system. So one thing that we need to know, if we're going to do Lagrangian mechanics, what we need to be able to do is to vary our action. So we need to actually just look at what happens to the determinant metric when we vary. So something that makes this particularly straightforward to compute is an identity that the determinant of the matrix is exponential of trace of the log of the matrix. So if I want to vary theta n, then I'm simply varying x trace log. So I know how to vary an exponential function. I simply vary its exponent, multiply by itself. But then I know how to vary log of a function, It's just M inverse the M. So that tells me how to vary vec G. So M inverse delta M is trace. So G inverse is just G with its indices upstairs. And if I take the trace, then I'm just actually summing over the indices. So hence G inverse delta G, all trace. And I've simply noted here, because we will need this, that if I want to, you know, if I, here I'm varying the metric actual proper. And on this side, what I've decided to do is to vary the inverse metric. To have the inverse metric as my variable. So you get a minus sign. So now what this means we can do is we're in a position where we can actually think about varying our action with respect to G. Why would we want to vary it with respect to G? Because in gravity, our observable, what we think, what we care about is distance. We measure distances between different events in space-time. So our fundamental variable is the metric G. So that's why we're going to want to vary with respect to G, because this is really our field. It's what's giving us dynamics in gravity. So in this case, it's our field, not calling an observable, it's really the field that we're interested in gravity. So if I wanted to take, say, the derivative of this vec g, then I use my what I've just derived here, so I get a half, 1 over root of vec g. I've then got minus g on the top. So what we've got here now, apart from being able to just actually vary our action, is this is also quite a useful identity. It's relating partial derivatives, the determinant of G, to the connection coefficients. So before actually deriving the Einstein action, I want to just look at something that's familiar so that you can see what happens when you vary with respect to G. We know that our Lagrangian is just our kinetic term. It's a half grad phi squared. So this tells us that our action is going to be the integral of a half with phi squared root g d4x. So if I now take a variation of the action, I'm going to have, there's two things I could vary with. I'm varying with respect to phi, and I'm varying with respect to g. So the first one gives me dA phi, dB delta phi, gAB, root minus g. And if I vary with respect to the metric, I get half dA phi, dB phi, delta gAB. And then I vary the delta g. So I've just written that down before. This is what we derived as the variation of the determinant. So this part is okay. The second part, I pull out my root g d4x. That's probably got the d4x, right? Then I can pull these two pieces together. Half delta GAB into 5 comma A, 5 comma B minus half d phi squared GAB. And then traditionally we simply integrate by parts. And if you remember in Lagrangian methods, you always assume that on the boundaries your variation vanishes. So for the second bit, I'm going to get minus dB, 1 over root g, because I pulled out root g, dB, root g, gAB, dA, phi, delta phi. So that's standard integration by parts. So from this, I know that delta of S phi, if I take a functional derivative of the scalar field action with respect to phi, I've got 1 over root g dA root g dA phi. And if I vary it with respect to the metric, I'm simply going to say, just remember that bit, because we're going to use that in a few minutes' time. But you should actually recognize this from field theory. Anybody want to tell me what this thing looks like?
Energy momentum tensor, exactly. So, as I say, just bear that in mind, because what I've said is we're going to derive Einstein's equations from an action principle. And what I've shown here is if I take a familiar Lagrangian, that of a massless scalar, and vary it with respect to the metric, what I get is an energy, or something proportional to, the energy momentum tensor. Of course, what we're more used to doing is varying with respect to the field itself, which gives us an equation of motion for the field. And this is our equation of motion for the field. And what that is is, of course, equal to d, the partial derivative, second order partial derivative of phi, plus the derivative of the determinant of the metric, which I just said was the connection coefficients times first order derivative of phi. And so this is just the wave operator acting on phi, which is what you would expect. You would expect that a massless scalar field obeys a wave equation, and on a curved space-time, the wave equation is simply the covariant derivative, the second order covariant derivative traced of phi. So this idea of replacing a sort of divergence here, this is like a divergence of a vector, or the equivalent of a divergence of a vector, with a partial derivative and adding one, you know, 1 over root g partial root g is quite a useful identity, which generalizes actually to anti-symmetric tensors. So that's an example with the Maxwell 2 form. That can be quite useful because it saves you from having to worry about the gammas. Okay, so far we've just sort of checked that our Lagrangian principle makes sense in curved space. We've derived a curved space equivalent equation of motion for something familiar, massless scalar. And we've also spotted that varying that action with respect to the metric gives us something that looks like the energy momentum tensor. So to sort of complete this whole picture, what we would like to do is to have a Lagrangian, some scalar, for gravity, which is going to give us the geometry side of the Einstein equations. So, for those that don't know this, what's an obvious scalar candidate? Ricci scalar. I've heard somebody whispering Ricci. So we've got a candidate. We've got something that is geometric, it's just related to the curvature, and it's a scalar. So let's just see what happens. So we know that our Ricci scalar is the contraction of the Ricci tensor with the metric. So that tells us that delta of r should be simply the variation of the Ricci tensor contracted on its indices plus the Ricci tensor itself times delta GAB. Well, that's already looking promising because here's our RAB. We know that when we vary root G, we're going to get minus a half R GAB. So there's our Einstein tensor. So that's all, you know, with no effort at all. The only thing is we've just got to worry about what this delta RAB is. So, so a useful trick when you're trying to do sort of calculate variations is to use what's called normal coordinates. So normal coordinates are local inertial frames where you choose a set of coordinates such that all the gammas vanish. Something wrong with my finger. Something's gone weird with it. So we said when we derived the gammas that, of course, they're not invariant, they're not covariant. And if you do a coordinate transformation, the gammas change. In particular, you can change coordinates to set them to zero. And this is like choosing our local inertial frame. However, the thing you've got to remember is that the derivative of gamma is not zero. So in normal coordinates, for example, you have that the Riemann tensor is just the first two terms. It's just the derivative of the gammas. So it's like thinking that your first derivatives of the metric vanish, but the second derivatives don't. And again, if you think of it in terms of local inertial frames, saying a first derivative vanishes is simply saying that, like, you're choosing your speed to match the speed of this sort of local object, but you can't do a Lorentz transformation to match accelerations. That's another way of thinking of it. So if I want to vary my Riemann tensor, I simply vary these gammas. So when I think about varying my my actual connection coefficient, what I actually end up doing is simply varying the parts of the metric that are being differentiated in gamma. So delta gamma of ABD, C is going to be So let me just rewrite this over here so you can sort of keep the end point in mind. So if I now look at this and start putting this together, I've got delta R BD times GBD. So what I do there is I simply contract on the A and the C. So I get that's delta gamma ABD comma A minus delta gamma A the A comma D. So if I contract here on A and C, this is simply summing here over B and C. And then, of course, I'm also contracting over the B and D indices. So you can see that these two terms are essentially the same, and these two terms are the same. So I've got to do two more things before I can finish off. First of all, I want to, instead of varying with respect to the metric, I want to vary with respect to the inverse metric. But that's OK, because I just get a minus sign whenever I do that. But the other thing is that whilst this expression is true in normal coordinates, it's not a covariant expression, because these are all partial derivatives, OK? So the final trick of using these normal coordinates is that you say in normal coordinates, your partial derivative is equivalent to a covariant derivative. So in order to get an expression that works covariantly, you simply go through and change partial derivatives to covariant derivatives. So in other words, you take all the commas and make them semicolons. Yep.
That's how I probably can sit the next line down. Yeah, I know. I mean, I was a bit obviously forgot about it. Yeah.
I don't think everyone knows that semicolon means covariant derivative.
I think it's sort of probably slipped it under the radar in a previous lecture. So this rule here is simply using the notation that you know, you've got dVA by dxV can be written as dB or VA or VA comma B. And if you put in instead covariant derivative, that comma would go to a semicolon. So that's that notation. So putting all this together, what it means is that, and I'm trying to get my metrics in the right place this time, is that the variation of RAB, now written in terms of the inverse metric, is simply the two different ways you can get a scalar from taking the second derivative of the variation of the metric. So what you notice about, there's two things to notice about that. First of all, it's a total derivative. So that sort of suggests to us that this is not going to contribute to our equations of motion. But the other thing to notice, although we won't necessarily be seeing why that's important for a little while, is that it's a second derivative. Okay? So first thing is total derivative. So this tells us this is not giving us another part of our equation's motion. But another thing is that it's actually a second derivative of g. So normally you argue that total derivatives are not relevant in Lagrangian mechanics because you do an integration and you get a boundary term, and you say in your Lagrangian variational principle is that you say that the variation of your object vanishes on the boundary. However, here what you actually are doing strictly speaking, we require not only delta G is zero on the boundary of our particular space or part of the manifold that we're looking at, but also that a normal derivative of delta G is zero. And that is unusual. Yeah?
So is the delta inversion acting on the scalar that's the contraction of?
In this case, it doesn't matter. But
because
it's G commutes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
But yes, you want, I mean, it's more convenient to write it this way,
okay,
because then it's explicitly.
Right.
I mean,
and we
absolutely
use that after explicit. We turn it into a covariant derivative.
Yeah. So yes, and actually, yes, you do that then.
Okay.
So, if you really want some serious tensor algebra practice, you can do this whole thing not using normal coordinates, derive the same result, which, you know, that's for the you know, the real mountain climbers. So, but it works. So just keep this, kind of flag this if you like. You know, we don't need it at the moment, but I am going to come back to it. This idea that this is where gravity becomes a little bit different from what you're used to with your field theory. Normally in field theory, your kinetic terms are first order derivatives of your variable. And therefore you only ever require the variation of your particular physical field to vanish on the boundary. It appears from this expression here that you require both G and VG to vanish on the boundary. And of course, by using the Ricci scalar, you're already using second derivatives of G as your kinetic term. So, if I write So I'm now going to say if I write my action as the integral of r root g, let me just put a little constant in here, then the variation of my action by the inverse metric is going to be c into rab minus half r gab delta gab. In other words, I get the Einstein tensor. So now if I compare this where, if you remember, if I vary the scalar field action with respect to the inverse metric, I can now put these together to see what this constant C should be. Constant is 1 over 16 pi g, I get the Einstein equations from the variational principle. So notice when you sort of traditionally derive the Einstein equations, you're not using an action principle, you're sort of deriving things about the geometry. You then come up with a tensor RAB, which was the natural thing to equate TAB, I think was one of the steps Einstein went through. But then that doesn't give the right answer, and you spot that RAB does not have vanishing covariant divergence, whereas TAB does, because we have a conservation law for energy momentum. In contrast, by thinking about this from a Lagrangian perspective and using a variational principle, we need to have a scalar, the scalar or scalar density here, we need to integrate scalars to get our action. And this automatically gives us this divergence-free quantity here. So the only thing that, the only sort of piece of work we have to do to get the Einstein equations was correctly identify the constant. So just to wrap up, I wanted to show you what would happen if you tried to generalize this a little bit. So something that you might think of doing would be to get a scalar, would be multiplying R by some scalar field. And in this case, we think about what would happen for our variation I'm just simply writing down now what we derived when I said this was a total derivative. So in this case, although the variation of RAB is a total derivative, because you've pre-multiplied by a scalar, you can't just throw it away. When you integrate by parts, you're going to pick up derivatives of your scalar. So if I integrate by parts twice and throw my derivatives onto the scalar, I'm going to end up with second order derivatives. My scalar. And so what we see is that we modify our Einstein tensor to include derivatives of this scalar field. What we've done, we've taken the Einstein tensor and we've added this extra scalar term. So this is actually Brown's Dickey gravity. And in Brown's Dickey gravity, we add a kinetic term, omega grad phi squared on phi. And it's an example, more generally, of a scalar tensor theory. So the reason that Brown's and Dickey and sometimes called Jordan Brown's Dickey theory cooked up this alternative to gravity was to try to incorporate something called Mach's principle. So the thing that left Einstein slightly dissatisfied with general relativity was that on the one hand you had this differential geometry, on the other hand you had your matter source, and you were kind of gluing the two together and using Newton's constant to do that. But why should things gravitate? So I think that there's a usual way of putting it is if you rotate a bucket with water in it, you see that the water sort of sloughs up to the sides. So if you were in an empty universe and it was just you and you did a pirouette, why would you, how would you know what your angular momentum was measured with respect to? Because after all, rotation is a symmetry of Minkowski space-time. But what sets the zero rotating frame? And so we sort of have this idea, we know we're rotating, and in the end, although relativity is done away with absolute time or absolute space, because we live in our Friedman-Robinson-Walker universe, we actually do end up with a concept of absolute time, which is cosmological time. And we do end up with a concept of a rest frame, which is the universe rest frame. So we kind of sneakily introduce these ideas back in a certain way. And so Mach's principle was somehow trying to embody the fact that your acceleration or your movement was with respect to the distant stars. And so the idea was you would replace Newton's constant by some coupling constant, this phi. If you think of this phi as being sort of, 1 over 16 pi g, or 1 over g, then you're making you're sort of allowing yourself to have a coupling constant for gravity, which is now not constant. And if you go through with this kinetic term, you see that the scalar field couples to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. And so you create gravity as a force by having matter present. So that was the idea of Max's principle. In fact, it doesn't. This particular theory doesn't work very well. The omega has to be essentially so big, something like about 10 to the 4, that it's almost indistinguishable from general relativity. But nonetheless, it's an interesting idea, and of course when you come to doing supergravity within the context of string theory, low energy string theory, you find that you do get something very much like this. So we'll sort of be seeing some of that a bit later. Yes?
We have already seen Young-Mills theory, so it would have been natural also to consider the square of the Riemann tensor as an action.
Right.
Can you comment on that? Why we don't
well, so the Riemann tensor itself.
The square of the Riemann tensor.
Right, so of course, so far I've just taken things which are simply first order in curvature. Of course, you can add higher order curvature terms, but you've got to be careful when you do this, because each curvature term is already a second derivative of g. So if you take curvature squared, you're adding essentially fourth derivatives of g. And so what this has a tendency to do is to add instabilities or ghosts. And so what it turns out is you can add the powers of the Ricci scalar, but if you start adding powers of Ricci tensors or Riemann tensors, you've got to be very careful that you don't introduce ghosts or correspondingly that you still end up with a second order theory which is well behaved. You can do it, there are special combinations of higher order terms that do that, Lovelock terms or Gauss-Bonnet, which you might have heard of, but you do have to be a little bit careful introducing these higher order, higher derivative terms. Okay. Thank you.